Episode 6 of By Our Own Hands. Sean and I left our new rooms and made our way to the kitchen. Mrs. Barry was busy preparing a servant's dinner. She turned when we entered. She gave us a warm smile. I was relieved that she wasn't in a haughty mood. "Dinner will not be ready for a good hour," she said. "I was hoping to steal an apple," Sean said with a meek smile. Mrs. Barry turned around and eyed him. She gave him a dire, serious look before breaking into a smile. "May I presume that this apple is not for you or Aoife?" she asked in a teasing voice. "No, it is not, Mrs. Barry," he said, grinning wolfishly. Mrs. Barry walked towards a basket filled with apples and took one out. She grabbed a knife and began to slice it into small, even slices. We watched her slice the entire apple in less than a minute. I had never seen anyone work so quickly with a knife. Once she had finished, she placed the slices into a towel and handed the slices to Sean. "Thank you, Mrs. Barry," he said. "Now away with both of you," she said, waving her hand. I was amazed at how willing she was to cater to his wishes. He was a stable hand and a child. We ran out of the kitchen and through the back door. We headed towards the stables. I had difficulty keeping up with Sean because he hurried ahead of me. I was giggling when we entered the stables. Sean suddenly became very calm. He motioned with his hand for me to be calm. We walked towards a colt that stood on shaky legs. It nervously watched us as we approached. "Aoife, this is Pegasus," he said. "Pegless?" I whispered. Sean laughed. "No, silly, Pegasus. Mr. Adair named her. He said it was a magical horse in ancient Greece," he said. "Oh," I said. "He said that only I could care for her. She is as good as mine," he said. I looked at Sean in amazement. He stroked the colt's mane. I could see that the colt already fancied him because it nuzzled against his hand after a few strokes. Sean turned to me. He held the bowl of apples out to me. I took one of the slices. As soon as I did, Pegasus moved his head and sniffed the air. Sean turned to me. "Now place that slice in the palm of your hand. Slowly place your hand under his mouth," he whispered. I looked to him for one more look of reassurance and then did as he instructed. At first, Pegasus ignored me. I looked into his deep brown eyes. After some hesitation, he took the apple slice from my hand and ate it. I gasped in delight. I took another piece, and once again, Pegasus ate from my hand. I looked at Sean, who was enjoying my delight. I cooed as he ate. "Sweet boy." Sean stroked his mane again. Together, we slowly fed the entire apple to Pegasus. We must have been in the stable for the better part of an hour before we returned to the house. We entered the servants' dining area precisely when Mrs. Barry was beginning to bring food to the table. Her hands were full. "Can I help you, Mrs. Barry?" I said. "I can too," Sean said. "No, no, so good of you both to offer," she said with a warm smile. Sean and I followed her into the dining area. We were expecting a full table, but instead we found only Old Man Seamus and Mother. Mrs. O'Donnell, Miss Boyce, and the McDermott sisters had been given some time off since the Reverend, his family, and Mr. Dare would be gone. That is also when I learned that the O'Dowlings would not join us that morning because they had just been sent back to Belgrove House. There was no place or need for them at the Glebe House. I had not seen them since my arrival and had not wanted to inquire after them. I was relieved to learn that Mr. O'Dowling would be far removed from Sean. Sean and I were both excited as we seated ourselves. Mother glanced at the two of us. "Do you like your rooms, children?" she asked. She spoke in a soft voice. She appeared to be preoccupied. "Yes, Mrs. Dorian," Sean said. "Yes, Ma," I said. My words were the last ones spoken at the table that evening. Old man Seamus ate quickly. He gave me a faint smile before he left the table. Sean and I watched him leave the room. We exchanged excited glances. We knew that old man Seamus was going to bring our things into our rooms. I knew that I had very little in things, and it would only take him one trip to bring all of my belongings to my room. I assumed that Sean's personal possessions were as few as mine. Once Sean and I finished our meal, we hurried to our rooms. Old man Seamus had finished bringing our things. I was right to assume that Sean's personal belongings were as meager as my own. I walked into my room and saw that my clothing was neatly folded and sitting on my bed. I also saw that my doll had been carefully moved to the top of the bed. I looked about and saw that the ribbon that Father had given me was not in my room. I checked the table and drawers. I searched through my clothing. I knew I had last seen it next to my bed in Mother's room. I walked into Sean's room and saw that he was busy putting away his things. I almost ran towards the other door. "Aoife, where are you going?" he called after me. "I have to get my ribbon," I called back over my shoulder. I hurried to Mother's room and stopped when I got to the door. I pressed my ear to the door and listened. The room was silent. I opened the door slowly. I was suddenly self-conscious of entering a room that I had been sharing with Mother. I crept inside and saw that Mother was not in her room. I saw my ribbon near the bed I had slept in the night before. I quickly walked across the room and grabbed it. I had the urge to run out of the room. I felt as if I were intruding on a place that was forbidden to me. As I hurried back to the door, I suddenly stopped in my tracks, as if I had slammed into a wall. I looked with amazement at the floor near the door. On the floor sat a new, shiny pair of shoes. They were beautiful. Despite my ignorance, I could tell that they were of high quality. I wondered if somebody else was to share Mother's room. The thought made me nervous and even more anxious to leave the room. I made my way back to my room. I was at a loss for an explanation. Anyone sharing Mother's room would be another maid. A maid could never afford such beautiful shoes. I knew that Mother and Father had saved for months to buy my shoes. Mine were for a child and not nearly as beautiful or well-made as those in Mother's room. The only people who could afford to buy such shoes were the quality people. As soon as the thought crossed my mind, I thought of Mr. Adair. As I entered Sean's room, I heard a sound in my own room. I walked into my room and saw that Sean was busy building a fire in the stove. He turned around. I must have looked as mystified as I felt because his smile faded immediately. "Are you well, Aoife?" he asked. "Yes, I am quite well," I said. I forced a smile. I heard a crackling noise and saw that he had already managed to get a nice fire blazing in the stove. He closed the door to the stove. "I know where Mr. Adair and the Reverend's family have gone," he said. "Where to?" I asked. "They went to visit Reverend Nixon," he said. "Who is that?" I asked. "Reverend Nixon lives not far away at Heathfield. It is a fine house, as fine as this one. About a month ago, he was returning home, and he was attacked by ribbon men. They shot him with a pistol and left him for dead," he said. I shivered. "But he didn't die?" I asked. "No, he clung to life and a doctor saved him. He is still recovering. He is finally well enough to receive guests," he said. "Who are the ribbon men and why did they shoot him?" I asked. Sean sighed. I could see that he wasn't really exasperated and that he enjoyed informing me. "The ribbon men are country folk that attack landlords and lawmen. Anyone involved with evictions. They try to stop the landlords from evicting people like us," he said. "By shooting reverends?" I said. Sean smiled. "I agree, that is bad," he said. "Why are they called ribbon men? Do they always shoot people?" I asked. I heard that each of them wears a green ribbon and a buttonhole as a badge of honor. They are a secret society and, he said, but anyone that sees the ribbon knows their secret, I said, interrupting him. Hush, Aoife, I don't know everything, only what I have heard others say. But I know that the ones that attacked Reverend Nixon were men dressed in women's clothing, he said, his eyes dancing. I began to laugh loudly. I shook my head. No, no, it isn't true, I said. Yes, the members are poor country folk. They need to disguise themselves, and they cannot afford to simply buy more clothes. Instead, they wear their wives' clothing, he said. I looked at him incredulously, but I could see that he was serious. They usually damage the property of wealthy landlords, but sometimes they kill people, he said. They sound frightening, I said. He nodded. True enough, Aoife, he said. I don't know why I did so, but I reached out towards the stove and touched the side of it with the fingertip. I pulled back immediately from the pain as the tip of my finger was burned. Aoife, are you mad? Sean hollered. My finger hurt, but I could not help but laugh. I don't know why I did that, and I don't know if I am mad, I said. Sean began to laugh too. He dragged me to the water basin and put my burned finger in the water. He shook his head. I giggled again. Suddenly, Reverend Matarin's words from earlier that day came back to haunt me. I grew serious. What is it, Aoife? Sean said. Your family name is Moore, not O'Dowling, I said. Sean blushed and looked away. Who told you? He asked. I could see that he was hurt and was becoming angry from the defensive tone in his voice. That doesn't matter, is it true? I asked. He answered me with a nod of his head, but he still wouldn't look at me. Good, I don't like Mr. O'Dowling, and I won't miss him. I am glad Mr. Adair sent him away, I said. Sean turned towards me, and a smile began to spread across his face. He is a cruel pig, I added. Aoife, Sean said. We both began to laugh in earnest. Once we fell quiet again, Sean looked at me thoughtfully. It is true. Mr. O'Dowling told me so. He told me that I was just a bastard and not his doing. He would not tell me who my father is, so I don't know. I wish I did, he said. We can pretend that Mr. Adair is your father. He is good and generous. He is wise, I said with childish delight. Sean sighed. Aoife, I have seen Mr. Adair instantly change from lighthearted to wicked, he said. My eyes widened. Never test him. Always be grateful for anything he gives you. Never, never argue with him, he added. I thought of Mr. Adair's outburst I had witnessed on the day that I had arrived. I nodded my understanding. He is still good, I said stubbornly. Yes, Aoife, he is good, but he is not my father. But it is close enough to the truth because he owns me. He owns you too, he said in a whisper. I did not answer him. I wanted to argue, but I knew that to do so was as futile as arguing with Mr. Adair. Mr. Adair possessed all of us. My tea has grown cold again. The doctor reaches across and gently takes my teacup from my hand. Do you believe that Mr. Adair possessed you and your mother? He asks. Yes, we were all his possessions. Some of us were precious possessions like my ribbon. Until he deemed us no longer so, I say, my voice trailing off. The doctor gets up from his seat and walks towards the teapot Mrs. O'Donnell has left for us. I know that any tea in that pot must also be cold. He surprises me by picking up a small bell and ringing it. I didn't realize that we had such a bell since I had never heard it rung by Mrs. Matarin. Mrs. O'Donnell must expect this because she comes into the room within moments. She glances in my direction with a look of concern. I know that she is grateful for the excuse to check on me. I can tell from the concerned look she gives me. I feel blessed to have her watching over me. I give her a warm smile. Her worried expression vanishes. Mrs. O'Donnell, I believe I have tired Aoife. I would like to take her for a walk. When we return, perhaps we can have our midday meal. I know it will be early. Is it too much of an imposition? He asks. Not at all, she says enthusiastically. Thank you, he says. And that is a fine idea. Take a turn through the gardens. At the far end of the gardens, there is an overgrown path that leads to a lovely walking path. I will have a meal prepared in half an hour, she says. Very well, we will do that, he says. Mrs. O'Donnell leaves the room. She calls over her shoulder as she does. Aoife, make certain to take your shawl. I look at the doctor and smile. Soon my smile is a chuckle. She is as good as a mother to me, I say. I can see that, he says, grinning. I get up from my chair and walk past the doctor. I hear Mrs. O'Donnell's shoes on the stairs. I am not fast enough. She has already gone to the cloakroom. I can hear the noises she is making since she has left the door to our room ajar. I glance at the doctor. He smiles. I know that she did not bury your coat. She is probably searching for my shawl to make certain I heed her instructions, I say. Perhaps you do not use your shawl as often as you should, he says, with a smile playing on his lips. I can't help but smile at this. Perhaps, I say, nodding my head in agreement. Mrs. O'Donnell returns with the doctor's coat and my shawl. She hands his coat to him first, and then hands my shawl to me. She gives me a wearisome look. Thank you. I will wear it more often, Mrs. O'Donnell, I say. Yes, you will, love, she whispers. She leaves the room. The doctor and I follow her. She goes to the kitchen, and the doctor and I continue to the main door. I can feel his presence behind me. He walks around me before I can reach the door and opens it for us. We step outside. It is cool and dry. The doctor has the right idea because it is ideal walking weather. We walk towards Mrs. Matterin's prized garden and find the overgrown path that leads us away from the house. It leads towards Lough Neagh. We start walking side by side. Our pace slows. This path will take us to Lough Neagh. Some say it derives its name from Nakali, I say. What does that mean, he asks. Na simply means of. Akali is a social gathering. The views at the lake are lovely. I suppose it would be a nice place for people to gather, I say. My country's barn dances are sometimes taken outdoors on warm nights, he says. In days gone by, any gathering of Catholics could invite trouble. The landlords and authorities were less concerned if a gathering was outdoors, I say. He nods his understanding. He does not speak. I look in his direction. He is hesitant. I know that there is something he wishes to ask me, but he is unsure of how to do so. Dr. Foxlow, what is it that you want to ask me? I ask pointedly. He looks at me with embarrassment. Is it that obvious? He asks, with a guilty smile. I return his smile. Yes, I say. We walk on. The path narrows and the doctor motions for me to walk ahead of him. I can see that the path will soon broaden. The quiet between us is unsettling. I feel his footsteps behind me. I wonder if he wants to ask me about Mr. Adair or Mrs. Adair. Perhaps he wants to ask about the letter I saw him eye all those weeks ago. Did his watchful gaze fall on that letter, or was that my imagination? I cannot be sure. I know that I need to be on my guard. I rush ahead to where the path broadens. On reaching it, I turn around and wait for him to catch up to me. He reaches me. He looks into my eyes for a moment and then looks down. I do not want to upset you, but I would like for you to tell me about one of your traditions. You mentioned a tradition that I had heard mentioned once before, but your description differs from that already given to me. I want it to clarify, he says. I nod. Relief washes over me. A man I was helping many years ago became angry when I stepped on hungry grass and another man told me that to do so could invite a curse. But you describe ground that is forever dead to any nourishing life. You neither warn me to tread carefully nor speak of a curse, he says. He looks up. His eyes search my face. I hold his gaze. The man who became angry with you probably lost a loved one, I say. The episode I speak of did occur during Ingorda Moor, he says. Were you in Ireland during Ingorda Moor? I ask, unable to conceal my surprise. Yes, for a short time. I accompanied my father. He was a doctor, too. He came to Ireland to help during Ingorda Moor. He brought me even though I was very young. I fell ill. I caught one of the fevers so common during those terrible years. My father cared for me. Once I was strong enough, I was sent home, he says. You were a child. I'm sure that he covered your eyes and tried to conceal the greatest of the horrors, I say. I pause before continuing. His thoughtful expression has grown serious. He does not avert his eyes from my gaze. Many people were left unburied, especially in the West. Their corpses were often devoured by dogs and rats. The spot of land where the unburied one fell was their final resting place. Do you understand? I continue. Yes, I may have walked on another's grave, he says. A true grave is complete, I say. He is silent. A life ends and death begins. A soul searches for Tekduin and then returns to the grave. This is not the case for the unburied one. Without a complete grave, there can be no complete death. A soul cannot rest if there is no grave to return to. A restless soul must wander the land. It is cursed, not the one who steps on the hungry grass, I add. Why does the grass grow hungry, he asks. The unburied one is stripped of life and death. The spot on which the unburied one dies is also stripped of life and death. It cannot grow nourished grass because that is life. It cannot simply cease to grow any grass because that is death. Instead, it grows grass that is hungry and devoid of life. It cannot rest, I say. Ingorda Moor is the great hunger, but there was one famine that was even greater. Some have blamed other famines on the hungry grass created by this earlier famine, I add. When did this famine occur? He asks. I am silent and motion for him to walk beside me. I know that by answering him, I will have to speak of how my family has suffered the curse of the restless soul. I will have to speak of how we cannot rest for long before we are forced to wander. It occurred more than 4 centuries before Ingorda Moor. It may surprise you, but this famine was not caused by your people or mine, I say. I can see that this fact does surprise him. Then who caused it, he asks. The Scots, I say. I take a deep breath and tell my tale, my father's tale and his father's tale. Isabella stood before a looking glass with a candle in hand as she chanted her incantation. Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, show me my intended. She saw shadows and images dance before her, and then a face appeared. It was the face of an old woman. She spoke in a whisper. Isabella's son will be a tyrant. He will leave your mother's land, drowning in blood and tears. Her land will be forsaken if he is not overcome. Do not fail to heed these words, for the time will come. She did not heed the warning. She did not bequeath this prophecy to her children, and subsequently they did not to theirs. Instead, she wrote it down, and it was lost for many years. Isabella was the favorite child of Strongbow and Aoife. She married and had several sons and daughters. One was named Isabella. This Isabella married and had a daughter also named Isabella. This Isabella married and had several sons. These sons joined William Wallace in Scotland's fight for freedom. William Wallace met a tragic end, but his fight was carried on by Isabella's sons. Three of her sons, Nigel, Thomas, and Alexander, were executed, but two survived. They were Robert and Edward. Their father was styled the Bruce because he was the chief of Clan Bruce. Subsequently, Robert was Robert of Bruce, and his brother was Edward of Bruce. When their father died, Robert became the Bruce. Robert the Bruce defeated the English and became King of Scotland. Edward was consumed with envy, but he could not bring himself to kill his own brother. Instead, he cast his eyes westward. Ireland's last High King had been dethroned because Aoife's father had invited foreigners to come and conquer. More than a century later, Ireland yearned for a High King that would unite her clans. She was a divided land, divided between the Normans, who called themselves English, and the Gaelic chiefs. Many hoped their longed-for High King would be Brian O'Neill, King of Tir Eachann, Tyrone. Brian enjoyed support from most of the chiefs of Ireland. All but one of the chiefs of the Seven Septs of Leash was willing to support Brian's claim to the High Throne. That voice of opposition belonged to the chief of the Dorians. When this chief was in his mother's womb, she dreamt of a raging fire that threatened to consume her. His father, Teig, knew that this was an omen and that their son would have to be fire to overcome fire. They named him Hugh and prayed that their son would overcome and not be overcome.